Hello and welcome to Brain Trust Live number 356.
This week on the podcast, if you run progressives, you sometimes can elect them, and that is the definition of being electable.
And eating out is nice and all, but what about staying at home and drinking alone? Forever.
Plus Donald Trump, where white nationalism and Russian nationalism find their grand wizard.
Plus, progressives can defeat mainline Democrats by thinking long term.
DC gets one step closer to statehood, Puerto Rico still batting zero.
And California Democrats try a crazy experiment, moving the party forward in a unified way.
We'll have all this and more.
This is Brain Trust Live. Hey guys, I'm Brent.
I'm Lila, and you can find us on the web at www.braintrustlive.com.
That's right.
You guys
can also find us not sleeping at night in the city of West Hollywood.
We have been following the fireworks conspiracy theory thread for a few days now. I've been following it for a few weeks. Brent just texted me finally to like, did you know that there are all these conspiracies? And I was like, do I know about the conspiracies? I sure do. All I do when I can't sleep at night because it's 4 a.m, I'm still panicking about firework sounds, is I scroll Twitter looking for conspiracy theories about the fireworks.
Yeah, and you can find them. They're there.
They're there. There are starting to be some reporters also asking questions about this, so I think we'll start to see some reporting on this soon.
Yeah.
But there's some... Listen, I'm
reports
not usually one for a conspiracy theory that's, like, flat out insane and...
Totally.
It has, like, deep state actors or whatever. I am on board with every deep state fireworks conspiracy theory that has been posited so far.
Basically, what's going on right now is that fireworks, like being set, illegal fireworks, are being set at a pace that is like unmatched in ever, really. Basically,
And also,
like, they were talking
in more places than anywhere.
In more places,
It's in
like
every city.
It's citywide. It's all over the place. Like, fireworks are illegal here, and they're up something like literally like 400% or something like that, reports of them, because people are reporting them to the police. And
right.
So that is where the conspiracy theories are starting to come in, because what is happening now is that you have police basically trolling every single area of the city right now because they're looking for whoever is setting off these fireworks. But a lot of people are thinking that maybe the fireworks are actually just giving police a reason to now be, like, literally patrolling every single part of the city. I said trolling earlier when I meant to say patrolling, but also
but
I feel like trolling works.
Exactly.
Because that's what they're doing.
The fireworks conspiracy theories, the reason that there are so many of them is because I can't remember a time that this has happened in every city at once, in places that don't normally get this kind of fireworks activity. So, like...
Yeah, it happens around the 4th always. Like, you'll hear,
right.
like, for the few days before and after, you'll be like, oh, some bozo is setting off fireworks.
Right.
But, like, not in every part of the city at all hours of the day. Like, literally at 7:30 in the morning, there's fireworks going off.
Also, not usually on the heels of a major nationwide protest. Like, this started a few days after the protest started, and it's continued consistently. And these are fireworks that are much louder than the ones you normally have around the 4th here, because fireworks are not legal in LA County. And the kind that you can buy in nearby counties are, like, those dinky ones that, like, you set off in the middle of the street and they go for, like, they go up, like, 10 feet. They're not professional quality fireworks. But what we have here is, like, constant professional quality fireworks, and that is being reported in every major city. So we're hearing that in New York and also in neighborhoods, you know, like here, there's neighborhoods that have more consistent fireworks than other neighborhoods, but for the most part, it's like dinky fireworks. And like, so there's like some parts of like Brooklyn and Queens that like have fireworks more often than like the Upper East Side. But like right now, everyone is being inundated in every neighborhood by tons of professional quality / louder than professional quality fireworks. It's happening in DC. It's happening in Philadelphia. Like, it's happening everywhere.
Yeah.
And so Twitter is on the case.
There are people who think that the police are passing them out themselves or setting them off themselves.
I think the conspiracy theory that I've settled on, as someone with no access to any verifiable information about any of this, but has just read a lot of Twitter threads about it, is that there is some sort of government agency / maybe the police distributing them to teenagers who are bored, because people are finding them in parks and being and reporting that their teenagers bought them off like random middle-aged white guys in unmarked vehicles. And like, look, the fireworks trade is an illegal trade in most states. So like, I'm sure creepy middle-aged white guys are part of that trade normally, but this feels very much like the people that fit the exact profile of many law enforcement personalities who are like leaving these mysteriously in parks for teenagers who've been in quarantine for 3 months to find. So that's my personal theory about what's happening. But of course, that's based on nothing. I mean, don't listen to me. I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. All I know is that I'm a delirious person who doesn't sleep because fireworks are going off all day and night. And I already have PTSD, so the fireworks leave me with like an additional hour of stress where I can't sleep after the final one goes off. So if they go off till 2 a.m., I can't sleep till 3 a.m. If they go off till 3 a.m., I can't sleep till 4 a.m. So I'm just like up.
If
you
want
to chat
not,
at 2 in the morning, like, I'm up. You know,
yeah,
if you need someone to talk to.
It sucks because it's keeping you up, but it's also like really sort of causing a lot of people to have PTSD, like anybody who might have PTSD over that. Yeah. I was watching the local news the other night and they were talking to, an older man who was a Vietnam vet who was just sort of like, I can't
anyone with PTSD, it's like a nightmare. And then the other thing is that anyone with pets is like losing it because their pets are freaking out.
Yeah.
The fact that I'm constantly being compared to pets isn't my favorite thing about the situation. People keep being like, oh my God, you're like my dog. And I'm like, no, I'm not.
No.
That is not why I'm afraid of fireworks. But in any case, yeah. It's not great.
No, it's not great.
Moving on from that.
Yes.
It was a big primary week.
There were elections.
And we finally have some election results to report to you, which is, as we state every week, the only reason we do this podcast.
Yeah.
We've spent years reporting on nonsense, but really we're just here to talk about election results.
I know, exactly. And we finally got we have some good ones. We're going to start with Kentucky, which could be good or bad. We still don't really know because they are still counting all the mail-in ballots because like they've got over like 500,000 mail-in ballots.
Life in California, you guys. This is the first year that we're going to have other states find out can't jump to crazy conclusions the day after an election.
The fact that Kentucky thinks that they're going to have results, full results in on Tuesday, a week after the actual election day, is really embarrassing for California because we're lucky to have votes counted 2 years after election day.
Right. Sometimes it takes months and months and then we find out the winner of an election was not at all what we were told.
Good work on Kentucky if they can get that done.
They can't. They don't know what they're doing. They don't know yet what they're talking about.
I know. Yeah.
It takes forever to count votes.
Right.
So we have
no idea what's going to happen in that race. We've been talking about that race for weeks. It's Charles Booker and Amy McGrath. Right. We're going to tell you where it stands right now, and we're going to tell you why that's either a good sign for Booker or why it means literally nothing.
We're going to tell you why it matters and also doesn't matter.
Right. But there are some interesting tidbits in this. So, like, it's still important to talk about. Right now, also, first off, if you look at Politico, you get one vote count. If you look at NBC News, you get one vote count. If you look at ABC News, you get another vote count. They're all fairly similar with each other, but it's odd to me that they don't have all of the same reporting because this reporting is coming from different, like, the same precincts. So, like, it feels odd to me. But they're close, so I feel like we'll go with it. But, like, I don't understand why there's not, like, an official vote count. That being said, right now, it's something to the effect of Booker having 30,000 and change votes and McGrath having 27,000 and change votes.
Yeah.
So it's about a 2,500 to 3,000
margin.
2,500 to 3,000 vote difference
in
favor of Booker.
Mental math on this podcast in your head just right away, like you're some sort of math genius and you're trying to brag about it. They have 13% of the ballots in.
Right.
So that's just a random number that we just gave.
Exactly.
So don't worry about the margin being right.
And they
don't even really
know that it's 13% because they don't know how many mail-in ballots they're going to get because they're probably still getting some. Although at this point, I think if you had them postmarked by Tuesday, then they would probably have gotten to wherever they were going to go. But to say 13% is just a crapshoot anyway because nobody knows how many people actually return their mail-in ballots.
Also, that's such an oddly specific number for a crapshoot.
I know.
13%, like you pick 15 or 10 if you're crapshooting. You don't pick 13.
Exactly. Now, there are some numbers that we can look at that might mean something.
There's also other numbers we can look at that might mean the opposite, so don't get too attached.
Well, one thing, and we talked about this going in we talked about this last week because Booker is from Jefferson County, which is where Louisville is, and that is like the major population center. And they have some reporting of it's going to be approximately just a little bit more than a quarter of all of the votes that will be cast in this entire primary are going to be coming from Jefferson County. They are reporting some votes from day of or early voting, because they also had a few days of early voting. We don't necessarily know exactly whether what this accounts for. But Booker has 8,300 votes and McGrath has 1,600 votes. So that's 80% to 16% there. And so you sort of have to think about whether that is a trend that is going to continue or not, or whether that was some same day or an early voting anomalies, because you're seeing a similar thing happening in Fayette County, which is the next largest population center in Kentucky, where Booker, and there's much less votes counted here, Booker has 1,500 votes and McGrath has 480. That's 72% to 23%. So you can think to yourself, oh, that's great, because in the two population centers, Jefferson County has 767,000 people and Fayette County has 323,000 people. And the next largest county is half of the size of Fayette County. It's like got 160,000 people in it. So you think, oh, well, there's no way that McGrath can make that up. But when you think that there's at least another 400,000 mail-in ballots to count, and that a lot of there's sort of this general thinking that a lot of the late voting and same day voting probably was going to go more to Booker than it would with the mail in ballots, because his surge was late and McGrath had all the money in the world and she was using all of that money to make sure people, she was running like a mail in ballot campaign basically.
Well, and she was running a national campaign.
And she was running a national campaign also, yeah. So, you know, it's going to be interesting to see how it shakes out. If any of those trends are even close to what the mail-in ballot says, where Booker leads by a substantial margin in those two places, it's going to be hard for McGrath to find those other votes, because there's just not enough humans elsewhere in the state to find votes to make up losing 80 to 16 in Jefferson County. But she's also probably not going to lose 80 to 16 in Jefferson County. She might lose Jefferson County because that's where Booker's from. Yeah. But can she make it up in other places? It depends. So again, it's very exciting for people because Booker is ahead and it does seem like it's going to be close. Like, I think that there was a lot of, I was going into that day sort of like hopeful about what was going to happen, but also sort of like ready to watch television that night and just have it immediately called for McGrath, because nobody actually ended up voting for Booker. Like, that happens a lot of
times,
especially
experience with progressive candidates.
Right, exactly. That happens when you're looking at progressive races. You have all of this hope that something is going to happen that was never actually going to happen. This seems like at least it's going to be close.
Yeah, well, and this is going to be instructive for us, because this kind of weird, unpredictable election where the method is unusual for the state, where there's been postponements, where there's been all of these additional factors, and we have this really high profile race, is really an unusual set of circumstances. But I think there are aspects of it that we're likely to see in future elections.
Totally.
That we'll want to understand the trends for. So as you know, like, we know from living in California, and this is something that I know is not well understood in other states, because I have to talk my parents off of a ledge every major election day about this, that mail-in ballots are a very unpredictable beast.
Totally.
You don't know a close race with mail-in ballots, anything could happen. And you just have to sit and wait for 2 weeks to find out. You don't get to find out right away.
Yeah.
And so I think we might learn the patience that Californians are having to learn with our states when it turns out McGrath wins by a huge margin.
Yeah.
But we also might learn that, you know, because of a lot of the, you know, I suspect that the mail-in ballots that have not yet been counted are probably more heavily McGrath.
But we
might learn that people wait till the last minute to vote.
That's the thing. I know a lot of people
unlikely to vote showed up to vote after they got excited about Booker, which would be a reasonable thing to do.
100%. Yes, I think you're absolutely right. Yeah.
We don't know what.
Yeah, because I think
any of this means.
I think something like 90,000 people voted same day, which is just a lot in and of itself, considering so many people requested mail-in ballots.
Well,
because they're going to have record turnout, by the way. This will be record turnout in Kentucky.
Considering also how few polling places they had open.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I mean, that was a big controversy
going
in. So when you have an exciting race, though, people try to vote. That's the other thing I think Democrats often misunderstand about contested primaries, is like, people really do their best to vote when there's an exciting race and they feel like their vote will actually make an impact.
Totally.
And that's a good way to get a groundswell of excitement going and get like a core of grassroots activists engaged, is to have a really exciting election where people are willing to wait at one of only 6 polling centers in the entire state to vote because it's that important to them. So hopefully the Democrats will be better organized as a result of this exciting last minute primary.
Well, and I think that there's so much besides the fact of just sort of like it's going to be instructive on how votes are counted and how we sort of like have to deal with waiting and sort of like what it's going to take to sort of like understand that we're not going to have immediate results, which Americans aren't great at. I have the tabs up with the results like on my like internet browser that I have not closed since Tuesday that I refresh every 7 seconds thinking that I'm going to have like some sort of result. And I'm still from California and know that there's not going to be any new results when I hit refresh, but I do it anyway. But I also think it's going to be, I love this race. You know, I was talking to somebody about it because, and we even talked a little bit about it on the podcast, just in terms of like whether this race is winnable or not in the general against Mitch McConnell. And I think the general thinking is that it's not, and that might very well be the case. But I do think that there is something, especially in a race like this, where maybe it isn't winnable, that I think that it is very instructive to run a progressive candidate like this, because like we might find out that this ends up being, you know, the closest race that Mitch McConnell has ever run in. And that might just be because everybody has finally decided that they hate him, but it also might be because there's actually finally a clear choice. And I think that this could be instructive for how we pick our statewide candidates in some places as we move forward, as not just whether we're running progressive challengers, but just sort of like also where the party lands on some of these things. Because like, why not try something new? Like, and we might, because then you can actually learn something from this. Running Amy McGrath in this race teaches you nothing. It teaches you that another corporate Democrat is going to lose to Mitch McConnell, which is a thing that we've known since the beginning of time that Mitch McConnell has been running, because that's the only person, the only type of person that we've ever run against him before. Yeah. So like, I would say that even if Booker ends up losing the general, like I would like to see how he does as like just a thought experiment, if nothing else.
Also, it gives you an opportunity to do some voter education around issues that, so that an actual discussion is forced about some of the progressive priorities that the Democrats as a whole should be embracing.
Totally.
Which means that voters in Kentucky in the future will not be like, socialism. You know, they'll understand what we're talking about when we talk about some of these policies. And that, in and of itself, is something that we owe to the voters of Kentucky, because we shouldn't, there is no state in the union that Democrats should just write off as a state where people can't.
Well, especially if they have a Democratic governor right now.
Exactly.
Who ran on expanding Medicare because the last governor got rid of
it. Exactly. So Alabama has a Democratic senator. Anything can happen if you try it. Like there are plenty of opportunities for Democratic victory that we don't pursue because we're sort of tied to being stuck in the same dynamic that we're always stuck in these elections. And I think you're right. Like, we know for a fact that Mitch McConnell can beat a corporate Democrat.
Right.
We can try to rely on this moment being a unique moment to get us to victory, but that doesn't actually teach us anything about how to run a race against Mitch
McConnell. Well, and especially if McGrath isn't a candidate who can actually meet that moment in any sort of substantial way anyway.
Right.
Like, you're relying on a moment, but a candidate who doesn't have anything to do with the moment.
Right. She just happens to be present during a moment. And we cannot win reliably if we just wait for moments. Like, that's not a way to win as a broad coalition of people. That's a way to win once when the president has fucked up so royally that everyone's like, maybe we're sick of this guy. It's not a way to win on an ongoing basis. There is a way to win on an ongoing basis if you try to think about how to convince voters that your priorities are actual real priorities that you will pursue and that will benefit them, which is not something we've tried recently.
Yeah.
Which it's is not the whole point of running for an election. So it's also curious why we're not trying it. It's a real situation. We had similar excitement in New York.
Right.
Which I always love, because I love when New York like explodes in some kind of progressive glory.
I know.
And that's, we, first of all, we got confirmation that AOC is not touchable in that seat. I think there was this sense among corporate Democrats that maybe they could eke away at her support if they ran a
They really thought they were doing something in this primary.
Yeah.
They really thought they were sneakily up to something. That's just really going to swoop in there in the style of AOC CNBC herself host. And just pull something. And yeah, they could not have been more wrong in any single way.
There has never been less polling done by any group of people in the history of the world. AOC won that primary by an amount that... Bloodbath.
She's in the mid-70s.
Yeah, she's in the 70s. And this was a primary against about 1,200 people. I mean, it was a huge primary.
But one very well-funded and one corporate Democrat who is got a talk show or a show on CNBC. Her husband is like an investment banker who started a super PAC on her part that was had a bunch of money from all of their Wall Street muckety mucks. And it did not matter at all. I think AOC's quote was something like, you know, it turns out money can't buy you a movement or something. And
I saw that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, she's so good at having a quote for a moment like this.
Yeah.
But in any case, and so Jamal Bowman also beat Elliot Engel.
Right. And we should preface this with the same. I've been surprised that New York has been so bold in their calls here because and that one I think is probably safe to be bold in. It's something like 63% to I mean it's a blowout.
The margin is pretty big, and also huge. I don't think there's so much enthusiasm for Elliot Engel in that district that there was likely to be it's not like he was running an Amy McGrath style national campaign.
Right.
He was just some guy who everyone has heard of because he's been in the district since the dawn of time, and everyone sort of vaguely doesn't
And had
mind.
Some Republican groups spending on his behalf.
Right. So I think that one is probably not subject to the kind of volatility that an Amy McGrath, Charles Booker election is.
Yeah.
But this, you know, it started to seem really obvious at the end that this was going to happen, but this was like a real upset, you guys.
Yeah, that's what I think, that like there was so much like you said.
Do you think beating Crowley was a big deal? Then beating Elliot Engel was also a really big deal.
Yeah, I think that it seemed like that this was becoming so clear that this was what was going to happen in the weeks leading up to it, that it seemed anticlimactic in a way, but it should not be anticlimactic to you. Like this is this is an AOC level upset.
Yeah.
Big time.
And I think also you have to sort of put it in the same context that you would have put AOC's victory in, where the reason that AOC beating Crowley was such a big deal is Crowley was like the number three guy. And Elliot Engel has a huge amount of seniority because he's been in Congress since the dawn of time.
Right.
And so this is once again like somebody taking on like the real deep machine in the Democratic Party and succeeding. And at this point, we also know succeeding because we had some solidarity on the left about it. You know, I think what we've been waiting to see happen this whole time, what we've been waiting with the rise of people like AOC to see and the rise of the Sanders movement to see, is seeing the left able to pull, you know, to pull victories out of the jaws of defeat on our own. And that is kind of what happened here. You know, we saw a coalescing by all of the progressive candidates who've ever run and won anything ever in their lives around this candidacy. And that's why we built, that's why it matters that progressives run in the first place. It matters even if they lose, because that is, you know, Bernie Sanders is not the president, but the first sort of like political coalescing of what was already a movement on the ground, obviously. You know, he didn't invent progressivism, but he helped organize it. He helped create an opportunity so that some other progressives could win. And they have done their part to create movements themselves so that all of these movements were able to finally coalesce around something. And it turns out that kind of works.
Yeah. Yeah, so, absolutely. And the same thing happened in...
The open
in a couple other districts. Well, at least specifically in the Mondaire Jones district, which is they're running to replace Nita Lowey's open seat, because he won, and that was another Sanders AOC weighed in on that. Warren weighed in on that also. Mm-hmm. He was a Warren Democrat, and Richie Torres also seems like he's going to win. He was Jose Serrano's open seat, not the most progressive in the race. Like I think the Sanders crowd endorsed what's her name, San Luis Lopez. You know, Richie Torres is not still, he certainly was, there was a somebody in that race who was like a Trump Democrat who and like on record saying a bunch of homophobic things and stuff like that, so we'll take Richie Torres. And also both of those two are now probably going to go to Congress, and they're both black gay men, and we have not had one of those in the United States Congress ever before, and we're about to send two. So
no, exactly, and we're talking. I mean, Richie Torres beat a not he's not just like a famously homophobic city councilman, but also because his son is actually the borough president there, who is a little bit more progressive than him. There was
confusion.
There was a lot. There was confusion in addition because Ruben Diaz is a name that is known in the Bronx.
Yeah.
Because there's two Ruben Diazes.
Yeah.
So there's that was a meaningful victory just because it required the electorate to overcome some inertia as well.
Yeah.
So that is also exciting, even though he wasn't, you know, the most exciting progressive in the race.
Right.
And then there's one outlier still that we're waiting to sort of, you know, some of the other sort of old line Dems kept one comfortably. Nadler's going to go back to Congress, whatever. Carolyn Maloney is in a really close fight right now. And
again,
I think they expect...
with their same challenger.
Same challenger, Patel. I think they're expecting the mail-in ballots to come in her favor, which I also am expecting personally as someone who grew up in her district. But this is once again like an indication that there is some dissent even amongst the, you know, the sort of more progressive wings of the party and some of these really establishment seats. I mean, Carolyn Maloney is the head of the Oversight Committee now. She's got a lot of seniority as well. And so the fact that this race continues to be this close with this guy who's kind of a goober, but kind of fine, remains fascinating to me. I think there is an interest in that district in having sort of a stronger touch, I think.
I think so,
you know,
too.
I think, especially because that district borders Nadler's district, and Nadler's district really does feel like they get to have a strong touch.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it feels like in Maloney's district, we should also get to have a really strong touch.
Yeah.
And it doesn't feel like we have the same influence.
Don't you think that, especially after two races, depending on how this nets out, even if she wins, and it seems like she probably will, most of the mail-in ballots were requested from sort of like her stronghold area in Manhattan.
Right.
Don't you think she probably starts thinking about retiring?
Maybe, but I mean, I think it also matters. She's in her 70s. Yeah, she could retire.
Yeah.
I think it matters, though, how some of these people retire. So I think there is a way that you retire in a district like this where you kind of pass the torch.
Mm.
And then there's also a way that you retire where you allow an open seat to kind of take its course.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of control in the Democratic clubs over that seat. That's a really important seat. It's a valuable seat. It represents the Upper East Side.
Right.
And so I think that in a seat like that, Carolyn Maloney, I think, could retire, but I think she would be expected to kind of keep it in the family. And I think that that is probably not what a lot of the voters outside of that base on the Upper East Side want.
Yeah.
So, you know, her retiring or not is almost not the point. And
Right.
you know, I mean, I like Carolyn Maloney. I've worked with her office really extensively. It's not a question of like necessarily even is she progressive enough, because she maybe is not as full-throated about some of the very progressive things I care about, but she's a progressive member of Congress. It's a question of process. It's a question of where the money comes from. And and some of those things aren't just addressed by her retiring. So I think maybe she retires, but I almost don't, she's not the problem here. She's just sort of like a symptom of the Democratic culture in that area.
That makes
that is
sense.
The problem.
Yeah.
And I think that's the case in a lot of these districts. I think that's the case in Elliot Engel's district. Elliot Engel himself is not the problem. He's part of a system that is the problem. That was the same with Crowley. He wasn't the problem. He was a fine member of Congress. You know, he wasn't an inspirational member of Congress. He wasn't offering any sort of great vision. But the way that the Democratic clubs work in New York City, the way that the culture around picking candidates for these sorts of seats work is what's being upset here.
Yeah,
And I think that is what to keep your eye on. I wouldn't worry about keeping your eye on who has what seat in this really kind of like literal way.
Sure, that makes sense.
But these upsets in some of these districts, like Jamal Bowman is not part of that Democratic club culture.
Right.
And that's why it's such a challenge. And that's why it's so great. And so that's what I would say about New York City culture. In case you wanted a really deep dive into Manhattan political culture.
I like it.
Which I know you were listening for. I know that that's what you were hoping someone in West Hollywood would tell you all about the Manhattan Democratic club culture.
Just locally in New York, a couple Democratic Socialists are going to the State Senate or the Assembly.
Yeah.
So that's exciting. Also,
we're continuing
like
the trend of it was the year that we got rid of the IDC. I feel like really started like a momentum. It created some momentum. It didn't end there, which is nice.
Yeah.
Because we have someone, you know, who is going to an open state Senate seat who's in DSA. Yep. And we have someone else who's going to run for a state assembly seat in Queens, who's DSA. So there's some exciting movement in the local political scene there, which is great.
Right. And then lastly, in New York, Sanders is at 19% right now. So as we know, you have to get to 15% threshold to gain any sort of delegates. And so he's at that right now. Seems like he's high enough now. Obviously, still a lot of votes to count, but is probably high enough to stay. So he's going to stand to gain a lot of delegates since, you know, New York.
There was
a
real organized effort around that in New York State, too, because I think, you know, it's hard to overcome the momentum of like a race already essentially being won.
Right.
But
exactly.
Everyone that sort of I know in that in who votes in New York or organizes in New York was like, really organized about making sure that they told everyone to vote for Sanders and that they knew that it was about the delegate count and they knew that they had to vote for Sanders delegates and, you know, so I think there was a real
good on them. They did it.
Yeah.
There was one interesting primary in North Carolina. We are now probably going to send our first Gen Zer to Congress.
Yeah.
And it's upsetting because he's deplorable.
It's always this way, isn't it?
It is. I know.
It's always some Republican who's probably rebelling against his parents by being even more horrible about everyone than they are.
Yeah, this guy, Madison Cawthorn, who's 24, won the primary to be the Republican nominee to replace outgoing House member Mark Meadows, who I think he's the chief of staff now, right? Isn't that what happened? I think, And he was going up against his 62-year-old opponent who Trump had backed in that race.
Yeah, so
and
it
he
is
won.
A victory
so he's at least not the Trump backed candidate, I suppose. I mean, if nothing else.
Yeah.
But it's a pretty conservative district, so it seems like they're going to be sending their first Gen Zer to Congress.
North Carolina.
He will be 25 by the because you have to be 25.
Right.
He'll be 25 by the time
he'll have gotten in there.
Yeah.
Some looks at some upcoming primaries.
Yes.
We talked a little back on Colorado.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about this last week, and I kind of wanted to revisit it because we hinted at something that as I was sort of like researching where this primary was at, just to give you a little bit of a better look at it, I realized who had been in this primary prior to Hickenlooper getting into it. And we hit on it last week when we were talking about how there were a lot of people who were upset that Hickenlooper jumped into this primary like late in the game after he dropped out of, you know, after he quit his presidential run. So it looks like he's sort of pulling away right now. We talked last week that maybe there was a chance that Romanoff was like getting a little bit closer, but he was still like 12 points behind, which had been a tightening. But like the latest polls like seem like Hickenlooper is going to win. But I think it's important to talk about that race pre-Hickenlooper joining it. And I think that this speaks to sort of like a similar thing that happened with what the DSCC did with McGrath, who granted didn't get in late. She was the first candidate in. But like they are sort of like want to pick someone and then just throw all of their weight behind a person blindly. And like it isn't always the best candidate. Because right now in Colorado, they're left with boring old white man John Hickenlooper and marginally less boring old white man Andrew Romanoff. That race looked insanely different before Hickenlooper jumped in. There were a lot of well-qualified people in that race, and they looked like America. I mean, it looked similar to the Democratic primary before it got down to two old white guys. There was a very well-qualified gay man who worked in the Obama State Department and in the Hickenlooper administration. I think he was the Secretary of Education in Colorado. There was a woman's rights activist who was like fairly well-funded, who was a lesbian and a Latina. There were three very well-qualified Black women who had either held elected office or had one was a business owner in Denver, which was like a fairly like well which was like a successful business. She was probably some sort of corporatist, like if I'm gathering.
Right,
but like she was also sort of like reasonably well-funded. And there were eight total women who had declared their candidacy before Hickenlooper jumped in. And they all, like half of them, like within a week, like dropped out because they were like, well, what are we supposed to do now? And that's not to say that John Hickenlooper might not very well win that race against Cory Gardner. But it's like, when you think about all of those people that were running and like putting in that hard work, and then for Hickenlooper to jump in and the entire Democratic apparatus to just like immediately throw all of their weight behind him feels really gross.
Well, I think this is like a problem with, you know, if we're wondering why our elected officials don't reflect who we actually are so much of the time, and why also you can have the most diverse and deepest field of Democratic presidential candidates ever and end up with Joe Biden as the candidate, it has to do with the way the party operates. There is no reason that Hickenlooper shouldn't have jumped into this race, but there's also no reason that the National Party should have
Right,
interfered
let it
in
play
a state
out.
primary. They should have let it play out. It is very possible, as we're seeing in Kentucky, that their choice is not actually the choice most likely to get support from voters. So it feels like, as much as I'm in favor of anyone jumping into any race they want all the time at any point, but it's when the state party starts to meddle in the choices that Democrats in state level offices or I mean, in state level races are going to be able to make that I think it starts to become problematic. Already, Hickenlooper has an advantage. He's better connected than
Right.
any of these other candidates. Some of them have worked for him before. He has the ability to fundraise without the party, the national party's interference. He has the ability to get endorsements that these other people do not have. He doesn't need organized support to do that. I think that's where a lot of the time people who would otherwise get a chance to shine because they are actually doing the work in their communities get boxed out because they also have the ability to get endorsements locally that other people don't have. And they also have the ability to maybe fundraise locally in ways that other people don't, but they're not given the opportunity to have an organized sort of campaign around it in the way that a nationally funded or nationally supported candidate is.
Yeah.
So it feels icky
It
to
does. It feels gross.
interfere in a race like this. And that,
And I'll
again,
say
is not
these are
to say
people that
that.
you, these are people, and I'm not saying that they've, like, these people haven't necessarily, like, left the Democratic Party, but also to,
No,
like,
but.
to force, you know, 8 women out of a primary because you've thrown all your weight behind John Hickenlooper, like, doesn't,
It's.
like, it doesn't, it just doesn't bode well for, like, who you say that you are as a party. Like, you would probably want those women to like run for something else. And look, maybe they will. But like, you
Right.
also just sort of like, you know, screwed them all. So
Well,
like,
no, exactly. And it perpetuates the problem that we're all sort of coming to grips with right now. It perpetuates problems where women and people of color just don't get access to the kinds of positions where they can help bring other people in and normalize the idea that our elected officials should look like us.
that's it.
I, you know, it, the, yeah, of course, Hickenlooper has the most experience of anyone on that list. He
Yeah.
also has been given the opportunity to have more experience than anyone on
Yeah.
that list. That should not be the only criteria that he has to meet in order to get elected to this office. And so he already had a huge advantage going in. And that advantage should have been enough. Because if he couldn't compete with that advantage, he's not a good candidate.
Right, exactly.
Like, you know, we support candidates oftentimes who should be able to win on their own merits. Like,
Right.
you know, if. And that's, I think, you know, what we're seeing come apart in Kentucky is Amy McGrath turned out not to be a candidate who could compete on her own merits
Yeah,
because there was a
exactly.
candidate who had a real track record in the community that, you know, was not able to get early support because there was this sort of like blackout of information about anyone who wasn't Amy McGrath. And we were all getting on national email lists. We were getting emails every day about Amy McGrath here in California, whereas no one had mentioned Charles Booker to me until my mother started fangirling
Right,
him.
probably
So,
like not that long ago, probably.
not that
I mean, I
long
know
ago,
she was an
no.
early adopter, but still, it
But
took, I
you
mean,
didn't have to
like,
be that early
McGrath's
to be
been
an early
running
adopter.
since, McGrath has been running for that Senate seat since she lost her House seat in 2018.
Exactly. So, in any case, some other
Yeah.
states as well.
Yes. Utah. Remember John Huntsman, that guy who ran
Remember
for
that
president and used to be the
motorcycle?
Utah governor? He's trying to do it
Cousin
again.
of Mitt Romney?
That's right. Yeah. Interestingly, locked in a very, very close race with their sitting lieutenant governor. So,
He's trying to Jerry Brown his way in. And listen, not everyone is Jerry Brown. We
Right.
can't all be Jerry Browns.
No, John Huntsman certainly can't be Jerry Brown.
No. And I feel like actually his inability to be Jerry Brown has more to do with the fact that he's a little cooler than Jerry Brown, just in ethos. Jerry Brown is like a wonk who everyone was just like, he'll fix it. Don't worry about
Right,
anything with
exactly.
Jerry Brown here. And like, John Huntsman doesn't give you that confidence because he
No.
doesn't seem as competent as Jerry Brown because he seems too cool.
Yeah.
Because he rides a motorcycle? Yeah. Jerry Brown rides a bicycle, you guys. That's the difference between Jerry Brown and Brown Huntsman. And then Oklahoma has an exciting state ballot question.
Yeah.
Whatever. What do they call them there? Props? Questions?
No, they're called state questions. It's SQ802.
That's infuriating. SQ802. Every state should have to call these things the same thing.
I know.
There is no world in which we should have... Like, listen, the difference between an amendment and a question, I get. But, like, the questions versus the propositions versus the amendments versus a state question. Like, get your act together, every state in America. Who has time to learn all of the stupid terminology that you employ? In any case, state question 802.
Yes.
They're going to vote on expanding Medicaid.
Yeah.
In Oklahoma.
Yes, they're one of 14 states who still hasn't done it. But some pretty conservative states whose governors did not do it have voted to do it. Idaho did it. Yeah. Maine, Nebraska, Utah have all voted under ballot initiatives to do it. Missouri is going to vote on it in August. So like that has been a way that people had sort of tried to, you know, do a workaround from their terrible state legislature or governor. So Oklahoma, and it's got some wide-ranging endorsements. Yeah. A lot of the state chambers of commerce have endorsed it. The Oklahoma Education Agency has endorsement. The Oklahoma Conference of Churches, whatever that is.
That feels like an important thing in Oklahoma.
Right, exactly. Their GOP governor is voting no, but he's an asshat, so of course he's voting no.
Yeah, of course he's voting no. Also, Oklahoma is having a huge surge in COVID cases right now. Like, this is actually, like, a moment where people in Oklahoma might hope that some people can have health care that don't currently have health care.
Totally, yeah. And the Oklahoma Healthcare Authority has projected that 215,000 residents would qualify under this expansion. That will be interesting to see how that shakes out. It would not surprise me at all that even in conservative Oklahoma, the people decide that they might want to have health insurance.
It wouldn't be a shock.
No. They also have a pretty hotly contested Republican primary for their the congressional district. Kendra Horn won the only race in Oklahoma, or she's the only Democrat in the Oklahoma congressional delegation to Congress, and there had been zero prior to 2018, and she won the 2018 midterm. She was sort of like one of the big shocks in 2018 because that was one of the biggest flips. It was a district that Trump had won by 14 points in 2016. So the Republicans have like a few, like what you would consider at least for Republicans, good candidates there, because the national party is really like laser focused on this one, because this is on toward the top of their list on races that they think they can flip back.
Yeah. They're going to be, I think, fighting real hard for some of these races because the national narrative is going to be embarrassing.
I know. I mean, like, just because Trump won that by 14 points in 2016 doesn't mean that, like, Kendra Horn doesn't just own that seat now, because, like, everybody has continued to hate Trump just as much in 2020 as they do in 2018, which is certainly how she won.
It's only getting worse, the hatred.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Speaking of presidential race stuff, we are down to the final four VP candidates, it sounds like.
Yes.
With additional options on hold. Right. The four in the lead are Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren, Val Demings, and Keisha Lance Bottoms.
Yes.
And then there's a few others that are still in the vetting process, but, you know, that being the sort of Karen Bass, Tammy Baldwin, Tammy Duckworth, Susan Rice, we've heard rumors of them.
Right. We hadn't heard Karen Bass. That was a new name that got floated this week. She's the chair of the Congressional Black Caucus. We have not talked about her at all.
Well, he's looking for any black woman in politics at the moment.
Right. Exactly. And then Tammy Baldwin,
thing about Karen Bass is she's in her 70s. No one knows this because she looks great.
Right.
But
exactly.
she's old.
Yeah. Tammy Baldwin had been initially on the list and then disappeared from the list for a while.
She asked not to be vetted, didn't she?
I don't know.
Was that her or Maggie Hassan? Somebody asked not to be vetted.
Maybe Maggie Hassan did, I think. Yeah. Okay. And I am wondering if she is part of the reason why she's she's being re-mentioned is because she's just basically like filling the stand-in place that Amy Klobuchar
was previously. She's the Amy Klobuchar reboot.
Right. And I want to talk about that really quickly because I had a thought about Amy Klobuchar's.
Oh, yeah.
Remember last week we talked about how she withdrew, which we all thought was hilarious because like we had all withdrawn her for herself. Right. And I'm wondering if this is conspiracy theory stuff.
Love it.
I'm going to roll with it. I'm wondering if she had been promised VP.
Yeah.
Because it took her so long. Like, she really held on before she decided to make a statement about being considered for VP when it became clear that she was obviously not going to be picked. And I suppose she didn't have to say anything anyway, but for her to come out and say, I think that he should pick a black woman now, weeks and weeks and weeks after we found out that she was, you know, had her, well, didn't have her nose enough in the George Floyd killing because of her time as a prosecutor in Minnesota, it really seems like there may have just been some work to do to unwind her from that selection process.
I think that that sounds like a very valid theory to me, in part because she was one person who I don't, she was one of the people that I thought, it does not make sense for her to drop out of the race right now. She's surging in her own, I mean, she wasn't surging, but she was somebody who I think stood to benefit, would have benefited, would have had increased leverage in the party, would have had increased leverage in the process if she had stayed in a little
longer. As others dropped out, yes.
And she, I think, had the money to hang on through for one more day.
Yeah.
Because everyone had the money to hang on for one more day. She was one of the ones, Buttigieg, I was like, why are you agreeing to this? This is an insane person thing to do.
And that's the thing, and we've talked about this on the podcast many times, but everybody who dropped out when they dropped out, that was obviously a coordinated effort, and that coordinated effort did not happen by somebody just making a phone call and asking nicely.
No, they were promised things.
They were promised things.
And I still want to know what Pete Buttigieg was promised, because he doesn't seem to be up to anything right now. So I'm curious if he's just like hanging around and waiting to be like the head of the State Department or something ridiculous.
Right. Yeah.
Because that seems like something he would do.
Yeah.
But they were promised things. And
yeah.
She seemed like, remember when we all heard that she was maybe in the running to be VP and we all thought, really?
I know.
Right. Like that, see, she seemed oddly confident that that was like a choice that should be made.
Totally.
For too long in this process, knowing that in any reasonable person's eyes, that was like,
well, and remember she also, and I had forgotten about this until right this very second. Remember when she accidentally called herself the VP?
Yes.
I literally, that just flew into my brain in this very moment.
Well, you just reminded me in this very moment. I pretended like I'd always known, but I had just heard it from you today. But no, she felt oddly comfortable with the idea of herself as VP. And that's crazy because it was such a dumb idea.
I know. Right.
It just didn't seem like it was just not a smart person's idea.
But before we leave this VP conversation, I think it's important to have a conversation about where we're at in the selection process, because you said something to me earlier this week that I sort of like, at least initially, I didn't write off because I never write off anything you say. I sometimes will like have a knee jerk reaction to it and then days later realize that you were right, which is exactly what happened here. Because I texted you the names of the four people who it was supposedly down to after I read the story. And you were like, can't they just, there are progressive black women out there. Like, can't they just name a progressive black woman? And my first instinct.
Win-win for everyone.
Right, exactly. And my first instinct was like, well, but like, there are, but like, maybe they're not like as well qualified, and maybe they don't make quite as much sense because they're like not from a state that would do this or that or whatever. And then like at 48 hours later, I was like, wait a minute. Republicans have been getting elected president up and down without caring about any of that shit. They look at what deficiency they have, and then they fill that deficiency with their VP candidate. That's what they
the whole point of doing any of this. That's where Hillary Clinton failed, and it's where Joe Biden is going to fail.
Right. You think about George W. Bush, his main deficiency was that people thought that he was potentially incompetent. Like, remember, everybody was just sort of like, oh, he's not the Bush that we thought we were going to elect first. He was young, he was a bozo, and nobody thought that he was going to know what the hell he was going to do when he went to Washington. All of those things were right, but he picked a literal nobody. Nobody had ever heard of Dick Cheney except people in Republican circles, but he had been in Washington since the beginning of days and had run had been involved in every single organization or every single department in Washington, whether it was the State Department or this or that
since
or the other.
The Nixon days.
And he made Republicans feel like they were going to be able to trust that administration when he got to Washington. Donald Trump had a very specific problem being a disgusting womanizer who had done softcore porn with the Christian conservatives, with the evangelicals. And so he picked the one person who could shore that up. Okay. So I would say, first off, the issue that Joe Biden has specifically right now is not with black voters. They are voting for him. They are the people who gave us Joe Biden. And so to me, I would say, like, we should continue to push Elizabeth Warren. I had a few moments where I was sort of like, yes, maybe it is time to put a black woman on the ticket. But I think, honestly, if we're going to, like, go into the convention and into the election with unity, then she's the answer. But beyond that, why aren't we talking, even if they're not experienced enough, why aren't we talking about Ayanna Pressley? Why aren't we talking about Nina Turner, of all people, which seems crazy when you first think about it. But if you think about it, when you think about it in the context of Mike Pence, it becomes a choice that makes much more sense.
What was Joe Biden as vice president about? It was the literal
white working class people.
Demographic opposite of Barack Obama.
Totally.
I mean, that's how he ended up in this position. It is 100%. What the VP slot is for. It is why the choice of Tim Kaine was not only dumb, but insulting to progressives, because it said to them, we don't actually need your vote.
That's right.
And that is what Joe Biden would like, or is sort of planning to do here. It's
what
Democrats
he's about to
do consistently. It's what Al Gore did by picking Lieberman. It's, you know, it's the opposite of what John Kerry tried to do, but then that turned out to be a disaster because of womanizing. The reason that you pick a VP candidate that is not just you is because you are looking to bring in voters that don't care about you. And do you know who doesn't care about Joe Biden? Progressive voters.
Right, exactly.
And a lot of them, it's just the idea that the idea that we have to vote for the most experienced candidate of all of history, and then also, like, no one is qualified to be VP because they don't have enough experience. Right. When Barack Obama was, like, an actual nobody who just randomly wandered into that office because he was so charming and such a good speaker, who had no track record to speak of that we could work with here. Like, if you're going to tell me that, like, he was more qualified than Ayanna Pressley as a one-term senator, I'm going to tell you that you're insane, because that is not true.
She's like, just as good a speaker as he is, too, by the way.
I would say better. I don't even like political speeches, and I was, like, having a
really
ball watching
taken
her.
With her. Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I just, like, the idea that we have to disqualify people who could actually fill the hole on that ticket.
Right.
Both the hole that the mainline Democrats obsess about, which is always just sort of like an identity politics
Thing.
And then the hole that the left obsesses about, which is an actual policy hole.
Right.
There are black women who are progressive all over the fucking place.
Yeah.
They're leading a movement about police brutality right now. Every single one of those people who's leading Black Lives Matter would be a better choice than any of these fucking idiots.
Yep.
Like, the idea that we don't have any progressive black women who we can choose from is, like, so fucking insane and ridiculous. And it's insulting that they seem to think that they have to play by these rules of being like, let's find the most establishment conservative black woman we can. And people, because she's a black woman, the left won't notice that she's basically a Republican. Like, nobody wants that.
I know.
Yeah. And I agree. I think there's a reason that Liz Warren is still on that shortlist,
and
it's because she's the obvious answer to their question. And I get that we're in a
don't
moment
wanna,
right
they,
now
they
where it's
know that she's
to
the right answer, and they're going to keep her on until the moment that they pick the wrong answer.
That's right. Just to make the left feel like, well, maybe someone was thinking of the right answer, but no, foiled again.
Right. Right. Progressive. Someone in the administration knew.
Right. Then they
vote
lost
for us.
It. Right. Exactly.
Oh,
but
God.
Yeah. No, I think it's like, it's such a frustrating circumstance to watch unfold, because you want to, like, I think there's a real kind of strategic difference between the mainline Dems and the left that no one ever addresses and that no one ever talks about, which is that the mainline Dems are so obsessed with superficial identity issues that they sometimes forget that the reason we care about these identity issues is because we care about policy.
Right.
And, like, of course, this is an important moment for the presidential ticket should also look like America. Like, the idea that we had this very kind of diverse, deep field and it ended up being Joe Biden is, like, so bonkers town craziness, because it should have been, first of all, there should be room for a Latino on the ticket, because a lot of America is Latino, and that, you know, there should be room for a black woman on the ticket. There should be room for a woman on the ticket. There should just be room for all of these things.
Yeah.
And there are, like 300 million people in America. Like, somebody fits the bill here. We just, like, it's like when people wonder why good jobs all go to white men, and it's like, well, we just didn't know any good black women writers. And it's like, there's millions of them. You just, like, haven't tried to meet them because they're not your friends. Like, this, like, we're having the same problem here where the Democrats are like, well, we just don't know any of the progressive black women that we, it's like, they're all over the government and all over our community organizing efforts everywhere.
Yeah.
They're some of the most important current voices in policy discussions that we're having at the national level right now, because we have a government vacuum. Yeah. And so the so activists are the only people having meaningful policy discussions. So many of the movements that we're all supporting right now, that are all really engaging right now, are led by black women. Like, there's just, there's no reason. This was your rant to go on, but I instead decided to pick it up and run with it.
I said my piece. I'm glad you're, and it originated from you.
But I was already having this rant, so I guess that.
Right. Oh, yeah, man.
So, you know, meanwhile.
Oh, guys.
You guys, COVID's back, and it was always here, so that's one way in which it's back is that it never left.
God. We are, like, actually, like, getting close to, like, the worst case scenario that we sort of, like, envisioned, like, earlier in the spring, which was, like, having an actual nationwide crisis, which was made worse by a vacuum of political leadership that is now threatening to overwhelm hospitals and spread out of control. Like, those were the things that we feared, which was why we shut down. But really, those things that we just talked about were really sort of, like, only happening in New York at the time.
Right.
That's not to say other places, like, didn't have COVID, because they did. Right. But, like, you know, we sort of, like, went through this whole process where we were like, okay, well, let's do this thing that we're going to do now, which is stay inside for, like, fucking 10 weeks. And then, like, we won't have this, like, national disaster where, like, the entire country is going to die of COVID.
Right.
But we didn't do that.
We decided not to do it. We decided to do the worst version of it, where we still had all of the economic fallout of going into quarantine for 10 weeks.
But then just opened up too soon, willy-nilly, with no plan, and then now it's a fucking disaster.
The whole point
again.
Of the quarantine was to get contact tracing efforts and other kinds of preventative efforts underway, and we didn't do that. Instead, we just ran around like chickens with our heads cut off for 10 weeks with no jobs, and then just like decided to come back roaring back as usual.
Yeah, we're up 30% nationwide since the beginning of the month, and we're also in a few states straining the hospital capacity, like in places like Arizona and Texas and Florida. Over half of the country, 26 states, have seen their cases increased over the past week, and like a ton in a lot of places, like 77% in Arizona, 75% in Michigan, which I didn't even realize because everybody's been talking about everything that's going on in the South and the Southwest.
Yeah,
But Michigan's apparently a disaster also. 70% in Texas, 66% in Florida, 47% jump here in California, and like LA County has some specific issues, which we're going to get to in a second. But also seven states, including Arizona, which is one of the bigger disasters, have set records just in the last couple weeks with the number of people hospitalized with coronavirus, and the percentage of tests that are coming back positive is also increasing. And so that also sort of like negates what the president and also Pence have been trying to say about the fact that like it's because we are testing more people that we're seeing so many more cases, because that's not actually true. We have been doing more tests, but the percentages of people who are testing positive is going up, and also more people are being hospitalized. So we know that we have more cases for real, as opposed to just more cases because we're doing more testing.
Yeah.
But I want to talk about LA County specifically, because it is a specific disaster zone. And it also has me specifically livid, probably because I live here. But also, I think it is sort of like a real microcosm of what has gone wrong in the whole process of the shutdown, and then just like the light switch on for a reopening. I know that they would say that they didn't just turn a light switch, but stretching it out over the span of like 3 weeks is like basically a light switch. Like you didn't actually like,
in the lifespan of COVID.
You didn't really do the work.
Yeah.
Because we now have the most cases of any county in the country. Yes. Any county in the country.
We're the largest county in the country.
We are.
So that is in part because we're the largest county in the country, but also because we have a wildly increasing COVID problem.
Right, but we thought we had it under control for a while.
We thought we had it under control.
Right, because we weren't anywhere near this number up until like our recent surge in cases, which is happening like very clearly right now. Our 7-day average of cases is over 1,900. 2 weeks ago, it was 1,300. 1,700 people are currently hospitalized. Leading up until the, at least the last couple of weeks, we had been anywhere between 1,350 and 1,450 in previous weeks. So that's up like a huge percentage. Our 7-day positivity rate of testing is at 8.6%. And 2 weeks ago, it was at 5.8%. For context, New York's rate is 1% right now. Only 1% of people who are being tested are testing positive.
And we were one of the early places to expand testing. So, you know, your positivity rate goes down if you expand testing, obviously, because more people have access to tests.
Yeah.
We were, so early on, we were always going on about like, ooh, we're down to 11%. Ooh, we're down to 10%. But like, we, because we expanded much more rapidly, we should have a really low positive test rate in this county.
Yes. And I pulled all of these stats from a, the latest press release, which I believe was yesterday, from the LA County Public Health Department. And it also, in that press release, reminds you that you're safer at home.
Yeah.
As like, literally the entire county is open for business. Our bars are open here. They're not anymore because Newsom shut them down because he had to do it for us.
Yeah, exactly.
And also earlier this week, the public health department tweeted, this is, I'm reading verbatim their tweet. Throughout our reopening journey, we have said that the number of cases will increase as more people are out of their homes and around other people. The risk of asymptomatic spread of COVID-19 still exists. The fucking audacity. By the way, like, first off, I don't remember you telling me that.
No.
Second off, like, you can't retroactively tell me that, like, oh, sorry, we knew you were going to die
when we reopened. Said you were going to die, you just weren't listening.
Yeah, I could not freaking believe it. And that brings me to, like, my issue here. And we've talked about this before on the podcast, just in terms of like who's to blame here, because like I sort of like went through my stretch where I was sort of like shaming a bunch of people online. And I still feel pretty good about doing that, if we're being honest, because it's entertaining to do. And like people not wearing masks at Trader Joe's is like an enjoyable pastime now at this point. But it's important to like continue to place the blame where it needs to be placed. And it's not on people who are going out and getting haircuts. It's on the government who is telling us that it's okay to go out and get haircuts.
It is their job to message vital public safety information to us. That is why we employ them to do this work. You can't know, as you're not a scientist, you don't know what you don't know about coronavirus. It's their job to tell you.
Right. You can't get mad at young people for going to the bars that you told them to go to. You can't get mad at people for not social distancing when you've told them to go get a manicure. You can't tell them that they're safer at home, but then also be like, well, we reopened the entire county. So,
you can't tell them they have to wear masks, but then open restaurants knowing that you can't wear a mask in a restaurant because it's an eating establishment and that everyone's sitting around indoors,
it turns out,
with no masks on in a restaurant, and that is like a thing that's like in a country where the national messaging has been so unclear.
Yeah.
To not provide clear guidance at the state level, especially when you know that there's a delay to how effectively that information gets to people, is really irresponsible.
Yeah. So anyway, Eric Garcetti also said something to the effect of like, we have to remember that COVID-19, you might think we're done with COVID-19, but COVID-19 is not done with us. Well, then do something.
Yeah. Right. Why? Also, there is no guide. There is no policy that you have enacted that would give us that impression. Like, it is your job to give us that impression. This is where I've been getting really angry, because the one thing that I know, as someone who does outreach for a public health or, you know, a sort of healthcare related issue, is that that messaging has a delay. So it takes a while for people to get the information they need to keep themselves safe in a situation where everything is evolving really fast and there's no real reliable source of information from the top. And everyone has been getting mixed messages this whole time. And that includes back when, you know, you were shaming everyone on the internet, like even at that time, people were getting mixed messages about what was and wasn't keeping them safe, largely because no one knew. But I mean, as a public official, you have to be in front of this stuff, because if you're playing catch up, then you actually have created like another 2 weeks where people
actually
have no information.
Right, it's too late, because you're already playing catch up, basically.
Right, you're always playing catch up as a public health official. When you're giving people information about their health that is going to be challenging to their sense of what, you know, of what they know and don't know, then you have to assume that you have to be ahead of everything because you're a week behind everything no matter what happens.
Right, yeah.
If you tell everyone to wear a mask this week, everyone's not going to start wearing a mask immediately.
Right.
It's going to take a while. People are going to have to post about it on Facebook. People are going to have to shame their friends. People are going to be angry at Trader Joe's when someone doesn't wear a mask. Like,
right.
It's like a whole process that you have the power to unleash, but if you don't unleash it, it doesn't happen.
Yeah, yeah. Ugh. Anyway, this is not going to get better. Like, I don't know what everybody, you know, like, some of these states have closed bars, but, like, that's not...
Well, I think there's also, and I think rightfully, this is an area where I think that the stay-at-home crowd and the open-up crowd maybe could come together on, which is that if we were going to take the sacrifice of staying at home, that time should have been used responsibly. If we were going to make the kinds of economic sacrifices in a country that has very little safety net and very little, you know, where people have very little savings, if we were going to make those sacrifices, the reason people got so immediately infuriated about this has a lot to do with the fact that they saw nothing happen. You know, they were told that we were going to be in quarantine for 2 weeks. 10 weeks later, we came out of quarantine and nothing had been done. Nothing had changed.
Yeah.
I think that's an area that all of us deserve to be angry about. All of us are losing economic opportunities with this. All of us are losing chances to see our family and friends. All of us are being put in danger by this. And that includes some of the idiots who are walking around not wearing masks, who also, I think, maybe prioritize economic achievement over human life, which is maybe not ideal. But I mean, they're also right to be frustrated that this policy that was so drastic, especially in our, you know, political system, in our economic system, was not used appropriately.
Right.
You know, if we were going to close, then A, there should have been immediate support available to everyone.
Yeah, it feels like a waste.
In other countries. It was a waste. And we lost out in that waste. And corporate America got bailed out again in that waste. And that is the same thing that we saw happen in 2008. It's why everyone's so disaffected right now.
Yeah.
So it just doesn't, like, I think that we are all right to be furious that our public officials, and that includes public officials in democratic states, that doesn't just mean idiots who were like, go to a restaurant anyway, we're too tough for COVID, you know, did not take this huge hit that we all took and use it responsibly. You know, if you ask people to do something this dramatic, you have to use it in good faith. You have to take the sacrifice and make it worth it. And like, they didn't make it worth it. So now we're going to have another year of this bullshit. You know, no one knows when they're going to get to hug their parents ever again.
Yeah.
And it's, we did the thing where we gave them the chance to fix it. You know, other countries managed it somehow.
Yeah.
And it's not to say they won't have waves of this come back or whatever, but people did not take the kind of hit that we took in terms of quality of life, in terms of having access to food and housing, in terms of all of the things that Americans are just on the edge of losing every, you know, all the time, and then squander it.
Yeah.
So, in any case, if you wanted an odd defense of Trump supporters today from me, you got it. That's a weird thing that I just did.
Well, speaking of Trump.
Speaking of Trump.
He was up to some shenanigans this week.
Oh my God. This week has been, also, first of all, before we move on, both Mitch McConnell and Dick Cheney this week also encouraged us to wear masks. The mask movement is coming back and things are getting wild. So just keep an eye on what's out there.
Yeah.
And also Mike Pompeo, I mean, not Mike Pompeo, Mike Pence, seems to have a lot of conflicting thoughts about mask wearing, which he now encourages, and coronavirus, which he thinks is not a problem. So it's hard to know what's going on out there. If you were wondering, though, about Donald Trump's plans moving forward, and specifically his plans for a second term, so is he. So you're so in it together.
Right. It seems like maybe he's not looking forward so much to a second term, or realizes that he's not going to have one.
This is our ticket, you guys. He has to not want the second term for us to not give it to him.
Yes.
He has to walk away. He could walk away without destroying everything because he thinks that it's the more exciting choice for him.
Yeah.
But if we try to force him out, he's never going to leave. So we need it to be his idea. It's like inceptioning a toddler to do something. You have to think about your plan.
But he got asked about what he would do as his top priority for a second term. And he had a real word salad here that didn't say anything about what he would do in a second term. But he said, one of the things that would be really great, the word experience is still good. I always say that talent is more important than experience. I've always said that. But the word experience is a very important word, a very important meaning.
So basically, he made vague references to experience, but really just the word experience, not right. the concept of
he
experience.
He has experience. So that's what his second term is going to be. It's going to be about experience.
Also, he knows everybody now.
Oh, yeah. Because he was from Manhattan, and he'd hardly ever been to Washington, D.C.
That's right.
I saw a lot of people on Twitter being like, you are from Queens.
Right. important note.
Right. So now he knows everybody. He said, I have great people in the administration. You make some mistakes, like an idiot, like former, like John Bolton. All he wanted to do was drop bombs on everybody. You don't have to drop bombs on everybody. You don't have to kill people.
First of all, that's literally the only thing John Bolton is famous for.
Right,
that is, the John Bolton experience is an experience of dropping bombs.
Dropping bombs.
You don't hire John Bolton if you don't want
to
drop
bombs
on people.
The only reason that John Bolton decided to join this administration is because he thought that there was an outside chance that he would be able to talk Donald Trump into bombing Iran.
John Bolton is a man who, wherever he goes, his agenda is to drop bombs on people.
Right.
There is no other John Bolton agenda. There's no John Bolton experience that is not based on dropping bombs on people. Like, you don't hire John Bolton if you're not trying to drop bombs on people.
Right. And also, to talk about all the great people in his administration, you know, he got asked by this at a press conference recently, which was hilarious. And it was sort of making the rounds on the internet. But, like, one of those reporters asked Kayleigh McEnany, because it was after the Bolton book, all the rumors in that came out. And, like, they asked, like, why the government or why the president kept hiring, you know, like, such losers, low-quality people with, you know, bad IQs and various things. Because, like, how many people from his administration that has he decided were, like, complete and total losers?
Anyone who left. Well, in this interview with Hannity, he went on for a while about hating John Bolton, and then Hannity tried again to ask him what he would do with the second term, and he went back to that weird Iran plane loads of cash conspiracy theory that he's always going on about. So he's hitting some... he's going back to some old chestnuts as well. He also of talked about a potential Biden presidency as if that might just be inevitable.
Yeah.
So he's going to be, he said, I mean, the man can't speak, and he's going to be your president because some people don't love me, maybe. In any case.
Yeah.
Some of his advisors are worried about this behavior.
Oh, shocking.
That's the news on that.
Yeah, they should be worried because, like, this is such a, it's such a softball question. Like, I could, anybody could answer this for him. I could answer this for him. I could even answer the horrible things that, like, I could think of for him to do. Like, literally just be like, we're going to keep building the wall. We're gonna add more miles to the wall. We're gonna get back to 3.5% unemployment. We're gonna
bring the jobs back to the Rust Belt.
I mean, like,
that
any
was, whatever
of the things
bullshit
that, just,
that he,
like, you know, I mean, this isn't hard. No. Like, that's a gimme, as they say, which is why it got asked to him on Fox News.
Because
they thought that it was a safe question for him to be able to answer effectively.
It's like the time he got asked for his favorite portion of the Bible, which I referenced to you earlier today, so that's why it's on my mind.
Yes.
The whole book. Experience.
Yeah. Yes.
Second term's plan is experience. And then he also went and tweeted a video of a bunch of white supremacists, and one of them was shouting white power. So that's cool.
He took that down. Said he didn't hear specifically the person saying that.
It was a video showing dueling demonstrations at The Villages, which is a Florida retirement community that if they are having dueling demonstrations at The Villages, Donald Trump is in trouble.
I was just about to say, like, who was in the
anti-Donald Trump The Villages protest? Because that is I read that he's actually starting to poll pretty terribly with people over 65, which is, like, the only group of people that the GOP wins. Yeah. So that's not great. Losing people over 65 is a surefire way to not be elected to be president.
Correct.
That's and
he's running against a fellow old person. So
exactly. There's no young person to make them uncomfortable in the race. The whole thing is just old people. But then his other reelection plan, which is to play nice with Russia, is also having some bumps at the moment because we found out on Friday that there's, like, a Russian spy unit that's been responsible for all the shenanigans, for that, you know, that 2018 nerve agent poisoning in the UK, for the election meddling. And they apparently are now offering bounties to Taliban-linked militants for killing U.S. coalition forces, including American troops in Afghanistan. So it turns out that the Russians are really only interested in sowing discord. What a shock.
Right.
And are trying to do that by literally paying bounties to the Taliban for killing Americans.
Right.
And U.S. coalition forces.
And this was supposedly reported by American, service members who were there. They were like, look, this is going on. And, like, it supposedly has been in Trump's daily press briefings. Like, it got reported all the way up to, like, the highest levels of the White House.
He doesn't read them, though.
But he doesn't read those. He claimed today
that he didn't know.
Right. He said that nobody had told him. Yeah. Right. Mark Meadows never told him. Mike Pence never told him. Didn't happen.
He doesn't read, so he couldn't have heard it from a paper.
Yeah. So, playing a little nicer. He's been playing nice with Russia the entire time, so it's not surprising that he's continued to do so. But, if we find out that this is true, I will be curious to see how Republicans take to this. Because, having the Russians help you as a Republican win a presidential election is one thing. Having Russians kill your soldiers will be interesting to see what the reaction is to that. Because that, I could see potentially, and I've thought this a million times and it's never been the case, but, that might be one step too far.
I mean, it's certainly treasonous behavior.
Yeah.
I don't know if they care about that anymore.
I'm not certain either.
I don't think they do.
But they at least always pretend to care about protecting our military.
Well, they care about protecting the idea of the military. They have again and again failed to protect actual service.
Well, I was
going to
say, they're the ones who are also, it's not the Democrats who are putting the military in harm's way.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I think that there might, for them, be a little bit of a distinction these days between the military as a symbolic concept of patriotism and the military as being made up of actual human beings who are American citizens who you don't want to cause the deaths of.
Yeah, yes, right.
That seems to be two different militaries.
Right.
For them.
I agree.
And it's, though it does kind of, I think it makes their long-term appeal a little bit more difficult to enact, because I think a lot of their sort of military appeal, not appeal to the military, but the sort of the ideology they have around the military is about Democrats not appreciating the sacrifices of our soldiers.
Right.
And if they are also personally behind the deaths of soldiers who they know a unofficial ally of the administration is paying bounties for the deaths
just because they didn't want to deal with Russia.
Because they don't want to cross Donald Trump and Russia, that's its own kind of problem, I would think.
Yeah.
My guess is that they pretend like this is not happening and that they've debunked it even though it's not been debunked.
Well, you might very well be right.
I think that's where this goes.
I think so too. But speaking of the military, guys, and I think this might be my favorite story of the week, actually. It's sort of tucked an hour into the podcast because it wasn't necessarily the most important, but I'm obsessed with it because we found out this week, and I was reading about it earlier in the week, but I didn't know sort of like what the end game was here or what the long game was. And I love that there is a long game, but Bernie Sanders, proposed
the very one
proposed a 10% cut overall cut to Pentagon spending. And the savings are going to be redirected as grant money to, quote, high poverty areas in the United States. So members of the Congressional Progressive Caucus are planning to use that amendment that Sanders is going to push as part of a bigger push to make drastic cuts to military spending in this year's budget in response to the coronavirus pandemic. And then also sort of like the economic impact and also just like looking at areas of the country. I think this also like very much has to do with sort of like what's going on with the defund the police movement right now, and also sort of like looking at things that we could fund that would, you know, go to high poverty areas, but certainly like areas specifically, where people of color would have the most, where this money would have the most impact.
Yeah.
But that's not really what is amazing about this story, because while that is a great idea, and I'm glad that he introduced it, and I'm glad the CPC seems to be on board and they're going to use it, they're looking beyond the immediate future with this and into next year. Because there's a few things that they think that they're trying to do here. One, they're trying to use it. This is Mark Pocan speaking here, a quote. He says, "I see this as an organizing campaign around the size of the defense budget. Next year may be the best chance with a Democratic president and maybe a Democratic Senate. So we're really going to do everything we can this time." So they're trying to hit this now looking all the way, like literally like 10 months from now when the new Congress and hopefully a new president is seated, because there's another thing that is happening at that time. Because there's this weird rule that is set to expire next year that ties defense spending to non-defense spending, which is the most insane thing ever. But if you cut defense spending right now, then you have to cut an equal amount in the non-defense spending budget, which has made it hard to cut the defense budget. Like,
well, it means you can't redirect defense money to anything, which means that a lot of it, like, it means that all defense cuts have to be cuts to the government as a whole, and not like you can't use the money for anything.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you can't move the money from cutting the defense to anything.
And that was the intention of the rule. The rule was a Republican rule, and it was designed to make it so that Democrats wouldn't want to cut defense.
Totally. And, you know, Democrats, mostly progressives, but Democrats have been sort of like calling for, you know, a reduction in U.S. military spending. It's like gone up $100 billion annually since Donald Trump came in there. So there's obviously like money to cut, and that would, and, you know, progressives and certainly even some non-progressives think that that would probably be money that would be better spent elsewhere. But it's going to be easier to do next year. And I am just like obsessed with the fact that the progressives in both the House and the Senate are looking ahead to like beyond January of 2021, because that
something
is
we've
not,
never tried,
because that is not the Democrats' way. Nancy Pelosi doesn't know what she's doing the day after tomorrow.
Right. No, exactly.
You know, so and this is like GOP level planning style. Like, they are always sort of like thinking of like whatever the most nefarious plan is, and this is not a nefarious plan. This is a great plan.
It's a genius plan, but right.
But I mean, it's that level of thinking where it's like the chess plan, you know?
Yeah.
That we just sort of like don't often do. We have not been good at over the years. And the fact that they are doing it now just to educate people within their own party so that they are prepared to do it in a potentially short span where, you know, it might only be the first 2 years of a Biden presidency where they even have, you know, assuming that midterms go poorly like they always do, you know, you might have a limited amount of time to do this, and they really are looking to do it at the first chance that they can.
Well, this is, I think, a nice thing about having some new people in there, is 100%. Having some people that maybe have a motivation to think about ideas.
Yes.
That you might have. Like, I think this is, we have become so protectionist of our, sort of policy protectionist, where instead of thinking about plans for the future, we're constantly talking about getting back to a place we already were at. You know, you see this with the ACA discussions a lot, where it's like,
totally.
we got to save the ACA and then maybe improve the ACA. But first, we have to protect the ACA and have it be what it was, what we intended the ACA to be. And it's like, because when you're protecting the ACA, that's not really a forward thinking plan. That's a plan where you're like, we'll propose something we've already proposed and maybe we'll get there this time.
Yeah.
Like something like this that is like, here's a long term vision we share. What if we planned to actually try something that would enact our long-term vision instead of just thinking about how can we get back to the level of military spending we already had that was too high before?
Right,
like,
exactly.
That, you know, this is about sort of thinking about how the process can accommodate you instead of just the numbers.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is something we have not historically been so great at.
Yes. Well, and Barbara Lee also is even calling for bigger cuts. And I'm obsessed with that, too, because, like, you know, there's this put, and she even said, there are two efforts. She introduced a non-binding resolution to attempt to cut $350 billion out of the defense budget, which is a lot, obviously. But if you consider it's gone up $100 billion every single year since Donald Trump has been in,
I mean, it's
right?
a lot if you think that spending on military is the only thing we should spend money on.
Right, exactly. And she said, this is her quote, she said, there's two efforts taking place at the same time. One is our 10% cut across the board this year, the $350 billion resolution we introduced to make sure we begin to set the stage and set the framework. We did that so we could start educating our colleagues and the public about the real savings that could occur in the defense budget. So it's echoing what Mark Pocan said, and what, you know, Sanders is trying to do in the Senate. So, like, good on them. Keep doing this on everything. Like, think about what you can do in January of 2021 in a limited amount of time, potentially having the votes to get some things done.
Well, and also think about what rule changes could accommodate your goals. Because
yes.
That's the other thing is I think we lose out on weird technicalities all the time because we're really dumb
we're
about
bad at that.
Rule changes.
Totally.
And the Republicans are ruthless when it comes to rule stuff.
Yeah.
They do not give a fuck.
Yeah.
And so I feel like if we start thinking proactively, like, okay, if we get the opportunity, how do we change the rules to make the rules accommodate our priorities so that the rules are not just stacked against us the whole time? Because the idea of not being able to even cut defense in order to accommodate other spending is a rule that hamstrings all of us into a system in which we have to keep spending the same proportion of our economy on or of our tax money on a spending that we always have.
Yeah.
So it means that we can never get out of the dynamic that we're in where military spending is king. And that is part of what prevents us from putting money towards other priorities is because we're always running out of money. Meanwhile, if we want to incur additional spending, we either have to find cuts elsewhere or we have to increase military spending too, which is money that we're just spending on bullshit surplus supplies that we're then giving to police departments to kill people.
Totally.
So, you know, it feels like if you're not thinking about the whole plan, then you're not going to enact any plan. And the Democrats have not been great about thinking about the whole plan, but the
right.
Republicans are geniuses at it.
Yeah.
It's the only thing that they're actually geniuses at.
Yeah.
And it's worked well for them.
It
it's
has.
Why Mitch McConnell is a person who does anything.
Exactly.
You know? It's because Harry
totally.
Reid was bad at the rules thing.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
In any case, the Senate Democrats tried one thing.
They did try one thing.
They finally tried.
Right. They waited until they had a little bit of cover, but that's fine. They waited until
them.
The NAACP
that's,
told them what to do.
That's them, you know.
But they blocked this Tim Scott Republican policing bill because they
that's
didn't
right.
think it went far enough.
Yeah.
The Republicans needed 60 votes to proceed to begin debate on legislation, and it went down 55 to 45 because all the Democrats voted against it except Joe Manchin, of course, and Doug Jones, of course. And then also, oddly, Mitch McConnell voted against it also because I think he saw the writing on the wall and he wanted to, like, go back to sort of, like, try and figure things out a little bit.
Like he was,
didn't want to, like,
yeah.
totally embarrass himself, so he just, like, voted against it. So, but, you know, Tim Scott, who was in charge of the bill, was hoping to have it voted on by July 4th, but the Democrats are feeling, like, emboldened-ish on this issue. So, and like I said, the NAACP came out at some point in the week and they were like, don't vote on this because the bill isn't terrible, but like, you know, we shouldn't be settling on things that are just not terrible right
now.
It's
just more of the same, this bill. It doesn't, it's the improved background checks of gun control.
Right, exactly. It doesn't ban anything. It just uses incentives to like, you know, to try and get police departments to like not do chokeholds because then they just like won't get federal money or they won't get sent tanks for free or whatever it is that they won't get. And then, you know, stuff like that. And also like uses incentives to try and get them to stop no-knock warrants as opposed to just banning them, which is like just ban them.
Yeah. No, exactly. It's
it's ridiculous.
But it basically is the kind of like lukewarm proposals where no one has to actually be liable for anything. So nothing matters.
Right. But McConnell, you know, had promised to have an open amendment process, which A, you can't let him promise you anything because you don't know whether he'll actually keep it or not. But like also Democrats, I think, finally realized that that wasn't going to be enough because all that allows you to do is to move forward and then introduce amendments that the Republican Senate votes down. And then you just end up being forced to vote on the bill that you were going to get forced to vote on to begin with. And then you end up with the bill that you didn't want. So I think they finally realized that that wasn't
it's only taken them years and years.
I was going to say, right. They allow things to move forward all the time with open amendment processes. And then, like, McConnell will be like, by the way, we're only doing, like, 12 minutes of open amendments. And then, like, we're voting on the bill. And then you get fucked.
Yeah. It's a classic
happens all the
maneuver
time.
That happens constantly that no one seems any wiser to for some reason.
Why is that?
I don't. It's wild how willing they are to accept promises from this guy. A man who's not delivered on any of them.
Yeah.
The only ones he ever delivers on are ones he knows he has to vote on.
Right.
You know? Like, when he accepts, when he makes a promise that he keeps, it's because he needs to, like, it has nothing to do with creating a democratic process. It's only stuff that he absolutely is going to end up having to vote on in the first place.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, because, like, I think there are a lot of people who are now sort of like, well, yes, we think that you did the right thing, and yes, like, somebody had to be in Washington, like, as a moral dissenter, because we never have moral dissenters in Washington. So, like, we're glad that finally, like, there's something that we, like, took a stand on. But also, there are a lot of people who are now sort of being like, well, it's looking grim, because, like, the differences between the House bill and the Senate bill are, like, so wide. And to imagine the two of them, like, going into some sort of conference to get a bill done, or the idea that Democrats and Republicans in the Senate will form some sort of, like, gang of eight to actually do anything. When was the last time you heard about a gang of anything?
Also, when was, like, the last time a gang of anything worked?
Well, I know, but, like, even, at, like, can you, like, remember the last time that we even talked about
we
it?
Haven't,
like,
had gangs.
We stopped having gangs.
Yeah, the gangs
there
are gone.
Because that's
a, that was a famous John McCain plan.
Right, we don't do that.
We don't
anymore.
Have John McCain anymore, so we don't have any gangs. Yeah.
So it does sort of, like, bring up the question of, like, if we can't do gun control after, you know, we shoot up a bunch of elementary students, and we can't do, you know, we can't save our economy in any sort of meaningful way from COVID-19, and we can't, you know, do police reform in a time that seems more transformational than a time that anyone, like, has ever lived in their lifetimes, like, what are we as a country up to?
Nothing. Well, this, I would say that the one hopeful thing about this is that most police reform is local anyway.
True.
So,
and a lot of,
this is one issue
there's
where
there's been a lot of heartening things happening in local departments.
And
so,
this is one issue where their involvement is not the final word.
Yes.
Whereas, you know, when it comes to figuring out COVID response packages, it really matters that they appropriate some federal money for that.
Right.
You know, when it comes to gun control, we have piecemeal state gun control reforms here, and it doesn't do shit because you can carry a gun from another state across state lines without anyone bothering you. So it really requires federal action. And this, look, it would be great if they could create some federal action on this. That's not to suggest that that's not their responsibility. But at least on this issue, there are ways for us to have meaningful reforms made at the local level by the bodies that actually control police departments that don't require their involvement. I would say that the fact that they can't get their shit together says that our local governments are really more important than ever, because they're the only effective government, and they're only barely effective at the moment, but they're the only effective governing bodies we have. I mean, when we think about even with the COVID response, you know, it's one thing with the federal money, you know, we required federal money to get stuff done. But when it came to setting policy, when it came to giving important public health updates, when it came to creating important public health policies,
local
it was
and state
governors and, you know, and city and city people, mayors that were responsible for
city
that
governors.
Kind of city governors that were responsible for that kind of decision making. It was not coming from the federal government either.
Yeah,
so
I
they're not up to anything.
Yeah.
The federal government is currently just sitting around sort of like showing up for symbolic photo ops, as far as I can tell. And then periodically we elect someone who has some vision, and they're useful as an electoral mechanism. You know, like the AOCs are useful in the electoral sphere, and they're useful in terms of just like having somebody in the room who like tries to do something sometimes. But like, you know, I mean, that's a good example. Yeah. She's setting a good example for other members of Congress.
Yeah.
But like, she's not empowered to do anything in there.
Right.
And that's partly because no one else has any incentive to do anything.
Yeah.
Well, they're keeping their jobs while they do this. They haven't done shit in years.
Yeah.
They've done the bare minimum for decades, and they're keeping their jobs.
Yeah.
So vote them all out.
Vote them all out.
And make D.C. a state so that we can vote out the president.
Yeah. I mean, the House passed that this week.
Yeah.
It's going.
Finally.
It's not going anywhere beyond that.
No,
but
it'd be nice if D.C., a city that has more residents than Wyoming, got to be a state and got
and
to
Vermont.
Vote in the presidential election. It would also be nice if maybe Puerto Rico had that same right.
Let's do
another place, another colony. That maybe we could give the actual right to representation to. And in D.C. in particular, you know, unlike in Puerto Rico, which has its own separate issues that are about its sort of colonial style of government.
Yeah.
D.C. has a lot of what happens in D.C. is controlled by the federal government, by people who have no interest in the safety, health, and well-being of the people of D.C.
Totally.
So they're really fucked.
And that feels extra, you know, wrong right now in our current climate, because also nearly half of D.C.'s residents are black.
Just some right to self-determination would go a long way in D.C.
Yes.
I mean, I know they should be a state. They deserve to be a state. They are American citizens who are being denied representation.
Right.
And but they also feels like voting representatives.
Right. But it also feels very specifically like you're leaving out 350,000 black people from, you know, the governing process in a very pointed way that you just sort of like don't want them to have a voice.
No, exactly. so that's... one reason that maybe bills like this are hard to pass is because their representative is a non-voting representative.
Right, yeah.
So
right,
maybe exactly. That's... Oh, and but I got my first ever vote for Congress because one of my friends wrote me in for Eleanor Holmes Norton's seat.
Yeah, exciting. So,
finally, my first vote for federal office. Here's to many more, exactly. And then in some California news to close things out, we had a kind of exciting state functionary thing happen here.
Yeah, I had been following this sort of like at least vaguely throughout the week because I'm on some like Facebook groups that are like Bernie delegate Facebook groups that like often get even a little crazier than like I am looking to be, which is like full crazy. So like just to give you some context for like the level of crazies that they enter into sometimes. But anyway, it was our... state convention this week, or like nominating convention for delegates, which happened virtually. I listened to a lot of it online today. Couldn't have been more boring, but I wanted to see how this vote shook out because there was a thing that you elect a delegation to like lead the state, elected officials to sort of like head the delegation of all of your delegates at the national convention. Customarily, it is led by the governor in Democratic governed states anyway. So it would have been Newsom, but Newsom is like persona non grata among progressives because among everyone sort of like right now anyway, and also among progressives specifically because he really sort of like dragged his feet on some things like, you know, Medicare for all was the thing that he sort of at least like vaguely promised. He's got a de Blasio style
problem on his hands.
Yes. So, a lot of groups, the California Nurses Association, which was Sanders-backed, Our Revolution, Roots Action, Progressive Democrats of America, and then also all of the delegates who were like going to be elected themselves, the Bernie delegates anyway, started this petition this week to have it not be Newsom and have it be Ro Khanna, who is you know, in the California congressional delegation and also was the chair of the Sanders campaign. And also they were like, reminder, Sanders won this state in a blowout.
Well, I was going to say, keep in mind, Bernie Sanders won this state. Right. Our delegation...
This is not something that they're just, like, trying to pull as, like, a, you know, to one-up somebody, like, in a state that, like, Sanders lost by 30 points. Like, this was a Sanders state, and it was big. Like, he, you know, this was his biggest delegate haul, like, by far, because he won it by quite a good margin. So, anyway, that had been sort of, like, festering all week. And, you know, the Democratic State Party muckety mucks obviously were not interested in having like a, you know, a virtual conference call argument that like devolved into like nonsense today. I'm sure a lot of the progressives were probably anxious to have that fight. Like they were really looking forward to it. It was going to like make their Sunday. But so the state party chair, Rusty Hicks, worked out an agreement with both the Biden and Sanders campaigns. And the progressives got what they wanted. The delegation is going to be led by Ro Khanna, Barbara Lee, who endorsed Harris in the primary, but like is loved by progressives because
she's a principled
progressive. You know, we just talked about her trying to cut $350 billion out of the defense budget. So like she's liked. And then also, oh God, what's her name? Oh, Hilda Solis, who was... the pick that the Biden camp gave. She had worked she was the Secretary of Labor in the first term of the Obama administration, and then she's currently one of our LA County supervisors. So it passed, like, bigly. Passed. 368-20. It was loved by all. So it was a good idea, and it was a good idea for a couple reasons that are important here. Because it allowed, like, you know, here's a quote from, it allowed Khanna and Lee to lead the delegation, which was what should have happened in the first place, because it showed that there was a commitment from California to the Sanders platform. You know, Khanna, his quote about it was said, it should be clear now that California delegates stand for Medicare for all, debt-free college, a $15 an hour minimum wage, strategic cuts to the military budget. This is a clear statement of what the delegates stand for, and that's important. But beyond that, the thing that we have been trying to do as a party that people have been saying is going to be like, oh, hard, and the Sanders people are, you know, whiny, and they're not going to vote for Biden, and they're, you know, like, just they want all of this stuff, and like, it's not going to happen, and like, everybody's concerned about whether we're going to vote for Biden in November or whatever. Like, this allowed us to actually go into the convention as a state, like, as a united front.
Yeah. Which...
And it good work feels... to the Biden campaign for allowing it. I know it's, like, just yeah. symbolic and, like, who really cares? But, like, imagine Hillary Clinton allowing this in 2016. No, she exactly. would have been like, you are a bunch of whiny bitches and you will show up at the convention for me and you will like it.
Yeah. No, and this is, I think, like, especially considering that the largest state in the union didn't vote for the guy, like, an important voice for them to have in the room.
Yeah.
That, you know, them robbing us of our representation at the convention after we voted for dramatically different priorities than what this candidate is offering is important. And it's yeah. something that I think the DNC of late, you know, up until very recently, was not interested in doing, even though it dramatically affects the way that they're able to turn our engagement into voter turnout and into grassroots excitement later.
Right.
I mean, it's the same way, you know, we're talking about this with the Biden VP pick. You want to be inclusive because that's, you know, the left has a lot of what I call high value voters. That's voters that do the work, that make sure that their friends who are less engaged turn up, that, you know, make sure that they're the ones who direct their friends which campaigns to go volunteer for. Yep. They're the ones who tell their friends how to vote on the propositions. They're the ones who tell their friends in another state something they might not have known about the process in their state. Yeah. And just because Californians only live in California doesn't mean that they're not connected to people in other states that are more valuable. And so you really want these high value voters, these voters who are really engaged in the process, to be fired up about the election.
Yeah.
You don't want them to feel like they got walked all over. And so they're just sort of like, good luck, assholes. See you later.
Yeah.
I mean, my mom was talking about how in 2016, Hillary Clinton's campaign made people in upstate New York buy yard signs so that they were not able to, you know, engage in any sort of like show of support for the campaign without giving money to the campaign. And my mom was like, listen, I know you didn't need upstate New York's votes, but like, you also don't get to decide whose excitement is more valuable to you preemptively. You don't know.
Right.
Like, these are voters that were going and doing work in other states for you. Yeah. These are voters that wanted to see that there was excitement on the ground for you so that they could go make calls. Like, you don't know where their excitement leads. And so, like, if you leave them out of the process entirely, you just forfeit all of that engagement.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, hopefully what the Biden campaign will not squander. They'll try. They'll do their best. But
right.
They were not in a position to squander it in California because he didn't win here.
Right. Exactly. Yes. So that's exciting. I felt good about that.
I feel good about that too.
Yeah.
And that's a great note to end.
I was going
to
say, we'll leave you on that note after bringing you a previous story where I just told you that we were living in a failing state.
Right. Well, at least we're not living in a failing literal state.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, it's a little bit failing because we didn't want our own governor to lead our delegation. But it's only half failing.
Yeah.
And with that, we bring you the news.
Right.
We'll talk to you next week.
Bye.
Bye.